Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Dr. Garber received her PhD in human and clinical nutrition from the University of Wisconsin in Madison and completed her internship here at UCSF. She is the nutritionist in the Division of Adolescent Medicine. She provides nutrition counseling and education to patients in the UCSF Teen Clinic and the Watch Obesity Clinic, where she has implemented a group behavioral intervention for patients and their families. Her research program focuses on obesity and eating disorders, including a long-term study of hospitalized adolescents with anorexia nervosa. In the community, Dr. Garber has been actively involved in public health efforts to combat childhood obesity, such as the San Francisco Mayor's Fitness Initiative. She currently teaches two classes in public health nutrition in the School of Public Health at UC Berkeley, and she is the theme leader for nutrition curriculum here at UCSF, teaching the medical students, and she's teaching with us now for the second year in the UCSF Mini Medical School. So very active, very involved. And please welcome, join me in welcoming Dr. Garber.
Well, thank you for that wonderful introduction, Dr. Kudring. I'm delighted to be here. This is always such a fun group to speak to because unlike the medical students always, people here actually wanted to enroll in this class and are here because of their interests. So it's just a great group. What we'll be talking about today are fad diets and what really works for weight loss. And this is a timely topic and a good time to cover this topic because there actually is a lot of evidence now on this topic. For a long time, the fad diets were not well studied, and now we've got some really big, well-done clinical trials that we'll talk about today and really go through the evidence. So hopefully, when you leave here today, you won't say, oh, it's just a fad, it doesn't work. You'll be able to actually talk about what works and what doesn't. So the outline for this evening's talk, first of all, I will start with obesity and health, just what is the link between obesity and chronic disease, so quick review, and then we'll launch right into the diets, and we'll do it from an historical perspective. So we'll start with low-fat diets and talk about where did we go wrong with low-fat diets. Hopefully everybody in this room is old enough, like I am, to remember when the whole country was on low-fat diets, but obviously that didn't work to solve our problem. Third, we will move on to low-carbohydrate diets, which are not as bad as we thought, as it turns out. And then fourth, we'll talk about glycemic index and answer the question, why, if you eat Fruit Loops for breakfast, you're hungry at 10 o'clock in the morning. And then finally, we'll wrap up with what we know now. What is the current evidence? And what it suggests is that one size does not fit all, and that perhaps different people do well on different diets. So this is a slide you may have seen before. I like to get the bad news over with all at once in the very beginning. And what this slide shows are data from the largest ongoing cross-sectional survey in the United States. And what they show are that the nation is getting more and more obese over time. So if you look at this slide starting in the 1970s all the way up to 2004, you can see that both lines increase. So the group that fits into the obesity category, this is BMI greater than 30, and the group that fits into overweight or obese, so it includes the pink line, you can see there's an increase. About 65% of Americans fall into the overweight category now, and about one-third fall into the obese category. What about the causes of death in the U.S.? What might be the link between this rise in obesity in the U.S. and actual chronic disease? Well, you can see here, these are data that were published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and they show the most common causes of death in the United States. And in yellow writing, I put the ones that have been linked to excess weight, starting with heart disease, second is cancer, stroke, and all the way down to diabetes. But when you look at what the actual causes of death, and this was published in the same article, meaning what are the preventable behaviors that are contributing to those deaths, what you see here, no surprise, number one is still smoking. That's still the biggest, in terms of behaviors, that's the biggest killer. But the second leading cause of death in the United States is poor nutrition and physical inactivity combined. What is this contributing to? Well, we know that poor nutrition and physical inactivity are contributing to a rise in diabetes. And you can see here the numbers from 1980 up to 2005 with a really sharp increase right here during the 90s, the steepest part of this curve. About 16 million people in the United States currently are diagnosed with diabetes, type 2 diabetes mostly, about 95% of those cases. What about heart disease? This actually shows more of an historic picture. Starting at the turn of the century in the year 1900 all the way up to 2000. And similarly, you can see a very steep rise in heart disease with a little bit of a leveling off. This looks a little bit hopeful here, right around the 70s and 80s. Anyone want to venture a guess here? I'll tell you that obesity, we already saw the rates were still increasing here. So why do you suppose the deaths from coronary heart disease leveled off despite the huge rise in obesity? That's right. We started to quit smoking as a nation. Excellent. So that really made a difference. And then, of course, we have much earlier detection now, better treatments, better medications. But smoking really played a role here. But again, looking at the steepest part of this curve, right around the 50s and 60s, this is when rates of heart disease were skyrocketing in the United States. And this was back when we were all still eating bacon and eggs for breakfast, the good old American breakfast, right? Saturated fat really was an unknown entity back then. But we asked ourselves, starting back then with some of the earliest big nutrition studies, what is it in the American diet that is causing us to die from heart disease? So the search was on very early, like I said, right around the 1950s. And the results of a lot of these early studies really pointed to fat as the bad guy. And I want to show you some of these early studies. But first, let's review just the classic risk factors for cardiovascular disease. The risk factors that put you at higher risk, or the positive risk factors, include smoking, like we already mentioned. High blood pressure is the second one. Age, of course, and that's unavoidable. As we get older, we're more at risk for heart disease. Family history of coronary heart disease. So if your parents had coronary heart disease, you're at higher risk. Obesity increases your risk. And then dyslipidemia. And here I show the classical risk factors. And I want to put these in your mind just for the first part of the talk, because early on, we really focused a lot on high LDL. So that's the lousy, that's how I remember it, or the bad cholesterol. Low HDL, meaning that your healthy or high-density lipoprotein is too low, and then high triglycerides. That's what TG stands for. If you had that lipid profile, you were considered to be at high risk for heart disease. The only negative or protective factor known was to have high HDL. So if that healthy cholesterol was at a high level, above 60 milligrams per deciliter, it was actually protective. Why do we care so much about LDL? Well, I just want to show you kind of a cartoon progression. If you think about the progression from a normal, this is a normal artery, maybe in a 20-year-old, and progressing toward a fatty streak and an actual atherosclerotic plaque that is at risk for forming a clot, you can see here that LDL plays a very important role in that process. LDL as a particle is prone to oxidation, and it tends to take part in this process more readily. So the role of LDL in the progression of atherosclerosis or hardening of the arteries was really what pointed to LDL as one of the main risk factors that we used to look at. Okay, so what about the early studies? Remember I said in the 1950s, people were starting to get worried, and the search was really on to find out what is it in our diet that is causing heart disease in the United States. Well, some of the biggest studies that were first undertaken are shown here. The first one was by Ansel Keys, and you may remember Ansel Keys as one of the most famous biomedical nutrition researchers. He was the guy who did the K-rations, remember, during World War II. He also did some very famous starvation studies. Another study that he did is shown here that's really well known. This was the seven country studies where he looked at cohorts from seven different countries and tried to correlate what in their diet was related to rates of heart disease. So what you can see here is a graph showing calories, percent of calories from fat increasing here along the x-axis, and deaths from coronary heart disease increasing here on the y-axis. And this is a simple correlation. So what it means is if something is correlated perfectly, you will have an R value of 1.0. This is about a 40% correlation. So in the world of epidemiology, people say, it's definitely related. You can see a line going up. As countries ate more fat, they had more deaths, but it's only about a 40% correlation. It's not that great. But what if you look at percent of calories from saturated fat? So just a quick pause. What has saturated fat in it? That hasn't changed. Did I hear bacon just now? I think someone, that's right on. What else? Dairy products, so animal products, so all that good stuff, bacon, butter, ice cream, cheese, those have a lot of saturated fat, of course, fatty meats. And you can see here, it should be no surprise, that some of the countries, here's the United States, land of beef and dairy. Here's New Zealand, also land of beef. And you can see when you draw this correlation between saturated fat and coronary heart disease deaths, now you have a correlation of 84%. And that is a very strong correlation. And this was very strong evidence coming out early in the 1970s to say, hey, the more saturated fat you eat, the more likely you are to die of coronary heart disease. And I just want to show you to drive home this point. Of course, scientists, we always feel the need to have an even bigger and better study. So we went from the seven countries to the 20-country study. And again, the relationship between saturated fat and coronary heart disease was very strong, 71%. And just to demonstrate, here's Japan. Very low calories from saturated fat traditionally, lots of fish, rice, and vegetables, very low rates of coronary heart disease. And here you can see the good old U.S., high levels of saturated fat in the diet, very high deaths from coronary heart disease. So these are some of the early studies I wanted to show you because this was really the death knell for fat in our diet. And it should be no surprise to you when I tell you in a few minutes that it was right around this time in the 1980s that all of us suddenly were supposed to be on low-fat diets. So we're going to talk about that in a minute. So the take-home message from these big studies was that saturated fat really was the bad guy. Now, again, very little was known about the Mediterranean diet back then. I'm pointing that out because you brought it up, and I'm glad you did. We're going to talk more about the Mediterranean diet. But really, the take-home message was saturated fat is bad in terms of heart disease. In terms of weight gain, it's also very well known and has been very reproducible in nutrition and feeding studies that more fat during overfeeding makes you gain weight. And I want to explain that a little bit more. These studies also were done back in the 80s, but they've been reproduced very reliably. What they do here is they take a group of subjects and they first put them into an isocaloric situation. So if I took all of the women in this room and their average calorie requirement was around 2,000 calories per day, I could put them in an isocaloric situation, meaning I would lock them up on a metabolic ward and feed them 2,000 calories a day. And what you would see is that these women would burn a little bit of protein, a little bit of carbohydrate, and a little bit of fat. Their food intake would match how much they're burning or oxidizing, and what would happen to their weight? It would stay the same, exactly. They're in an isocaloric situation. Now I want to put these women in a hypercaloric situation, or what I call like Thanksgiving dinner situation for 2 or 3 weeks, where we're feeding them 3,000 calories per day, which is really easy to do, right? It's an extra slice of cake, and you're, with your afternoon coffee, and a bigger portion of dinner. So they're taking in 3,000 calories, but they're still only burning right around 2,000 calories. People tend to burn a little bit more when you overfeed them, but they certainly don't burn 1,000 calories more. But what you can see here, if you compare the white bars, the size here, to the size here, the women start oxidizing more protein, they start burning more carbohydrate. But what happens to all of the fat? It goes straight into storage. So if you are eating too many calories, it is the fat that is preferentially stored. And anyone want to venture a guess why that is? It is easier to store fat in fat. It is less metabolically costly to store fat, and so the body preferentially stores fat. So if you're eating too much, it is the calories from fat that go into storage. Okay? So like I said, these studies were all done very early on. They came on the tail end of these huge epidemiologic studies that said heart disease is the major contributor is saturated fat. So people really were down on fat in the 80s. And no surprise, and I hope you all remember this, low-fat diets were the major recommendation in the United States from the American Heart Association. Remember the Step 1 and Step 2, they're still around. The National Cholesterol Education Program, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, the American Cancer Institute. All of these associations were coming in the 80s and telling us we needed to go on low-fat diets. And at this time, the American public tried their best to comply. We all stopped eating bacon and eggs for breakfast and quickly went to Noah's Bagels and got big, white, fluffy bagels, remember? We started snacking on rice cakes and pretzels all day long because they were fat-free, so you could eat the whole bag. So, but I showed you, don't forget, I showed you that the rates of obesity in the United States and the rates of diabetes kept right on going up during this time in the 80s. So the question is, what went wrong with our low-fat diets? First of all, let's just review. This is a real menu from a low-fat diet. This is from the Obesity Education Initiative. And what you can see here, first thing, it's a lower-calorie diet, so it's 1,600 calories. It did involve some whole grains, so whole wheat bread at breakfast, whole wheat bread for lunch, but it also still involved some white fluffies is what I call them, so foods that don't have any fiber, like a baked potato or a white dinner roll. They did try to switch out, obviously, some of the American staples, like a hamburger, switched out for a roast beef sandwich because it's slightly leaner. Low-fat American cheese instead of a slice of cheddar cheese. Low-fat mayonnaise. But what do you think of when you see this? What's in margarine we know now? Trans fat. Again, this is something that wasn't known back in the 70s and 80s when these diets were being developed. Everybody thought, well, we'll switch to margarine. It's cholesterol-free, and it's made with vegetable oil. So this was a mistake we made, and we'll come back to this. But there were some problems with low-fat diets that we're going to discuss. First, I want to give you the good news. Low-fat diets did work if they were done correctly. And the best evidence to show this comes from UCSF, actually, when Dean Ornish was still here. He did the Ornish Lifestyle Heart Trials. This was in 1990 and 1998. And the Ornish Lifestyle diets were truly very low-fat diets. In fact, they were nearly vegan, which means almost or virtually no animal products at all. So these were extremely low-fat diets. You cannot ignore that the people on these programs also had an exercise component and they had a stress management component, which we know now is very important for weight control. But what he showed that was so impressive is after 1 year and 5 years on his vegan diet, he actually showed regression in coronary artery disease. So remember the plaque progression that I showed you, fatty streak? He actually showed a slight reversal of that process, which had not been seen before. So this really encouraged us in the 80s and 90s to say, wow, low-fat diets can be fantastic. They can really work. But here are the problems, and the problems with low-fat diets really turned out to be big ones. The first problem with low-fat diets is that it's really not easy to achieve a low-fat diet, and even if you can, it's difficult to stick to it. And we know that now from the Women's Health Initiative. So how many people remember the Women's Health Initiative? Because you got, yeah, you're all avid readers, and this was in the New York Times. Remember the hormone replacement therapy arm of this study really made a big splash. Not a lot of people heard about the low-fat arm of the study, but it was part of the Women's Health Initiative. This is the largest ever study of low-fat diets. diets. It was in almost 50,000 postmenopausal women. They were intended to be on a 20% fat diet. So how does that compare to what we're eating in the United States? What percent of our calories come from fat in the U.S.? I hear 36. I heard 30. I think we're somewhere around 33 or 34 now, but it was higher back in the day. But this was a truly low-fat diet, aiming for 20%. The emphasis was on fruits and vegetables and whole grains. Here's the disappointing news. After nearly 8 years on a low-fat diet, the women only lost 1.9 kilos. It's about 4, maybe 4.5 pounds. So this is 4.5 pounds of weight loss versus almost a pound that the control group lost over 8 years. So that's 4.5 pounds out of 8 years of eating low-fat American cheese. That's not good. The really disappointing note was that there was absolutely no difference in cancer rates between the two groups, the control versus the low-fat, and there was no difference in incidence of cardiovascular disease. So this was a bummer. Now, there were some problems. The study the conclusion is not that low-fat diets don't work. The conclusion is that it's very difficult to get people on a large scale to truly adhere to a low-fat diet. What they found is that the lowest the women ever got was around 24% calories from fat. They never quite made it to 20. And by 8 years on the study, they had drifted back up to 29%. So it's difficult to stick to, and that might be one of the big lessons that comes out of this study. The other problem with this study is that it started with postmenopausal women. And one suggestion is that maybe you need to start with younger women on a low-fat diet in order to prevent cancer or prevent cardiovascular disease. Okay. The second problem with low-fat diets is that we misinterpreted it in the United States. I call this the Entenmann's fat-free bakery product phenomenon. Remember? Fat-free, go ahead and eat the whole box. Well, this actually turns out to be true. And if you look at data that were released by the CDC, what they showed is from 1970 until the year 2000, protein levels as a percent stayed just about the same. Fat levels appeared to decrease. But the problem is this is a percentage, and it turns out it looks like it decreased because our total calories actually increased. So the denominator here is larger, and it made it appear as though we were eating less fat when really we kept eating about the same amount of fat, but we increased our calories. In fact, during this time period, women increased their calorie intake by about 335 calories per day. And look at this increase in carbohydrate intake from 44% to 50%. So during this time, we increased our calories, and most of it came from carbohydrate. And it was these well-known foods. It was bagels for breakfast, like I said. It was snacking on fat-free items. And that turned out to be a problem because it contributed a lot of calories. And as the person in the front brought up, we cannot ignore that calories contribute to weight gain. And we'll come back to that. The third big problem with low-fat diets is that we did not understand the link between coronary heart disease and diabetes. It was not until 1988 that Gerald Reven at Stanford coined this term, the metabolic syndrome. And originally this was called insulin resistance syndrome. People sometimes still call it syndrome X. But the point is that it describes a constellation of risk factors that revolve around insulin resistance. So you have high triglycerides. Remember that from our classical risk factors? Low HDL, also a classical risk factor. Hypertension and high insulin. And this constellation of obesity-related metabolic derangements all act as risk factors for both heart disease and diabetes. So the newer criteria now, if you're thinking about risk, remember the old list we had with you're thinking about risk factors for heart disease. Now you need to think about risk factors for heart disease and diabetes. And here are the ATP3 criteria, and these come from the National Cholesterol Education Program. And the risk factors now are abdominal obesity, because this is a proxy for visceral fat, which is probably the more dangerous type of fat. It's the fat this intra-organal or between the organs. Triglycerides, high triglycerides. HDL is still on there. If you have low HDL, that's a risk factor. High blood pressure And now look, we have elevated fasting glucose. So that's the piece now of risk for diabetes that's been added into this risk profile. Notice that you don't see LDL on this picture, total LDL, and you also don't see total cholesterol on this picture. I want to just mention this idea of high fasting glucose is not quite diabetes, but it's considered pre-diabetes. Prediabetes is actually considered kind of like the beginning or the lead-in to having being high risk or the development of diabetes. And it may affect up to 40% of adults in the United States. So here's just the quick review. And I know this looks cartoonish, but actually someone won a Nobel Prize for this block and key model. So insulin is a very important hormone that everybody makes, hopefully, unless you have really advanced diabetes, at which point you stop making insulin. The LOX, this is supposed to represent this circle, a cell. And the LOX are the receptors for insulin. So they are the lock that is waiting for insulin, which is the key. The key is going to come along when there's glucose in the blood. So let's say you had your bagel or your Entenmann's fat-free coffee cake for breakfast. There's a bunch of glucose or sugar floating around in your blood. In response to that, the pancreas secretes insulin, this hormone. It finds the key, the key finds the locks, opens the gates, and the glucose is allowed to go into the cell. And this is actually normal cellular metabolism and normal functioning. Of course, it's very simplified just so we could squeeze it into two slides for tonight. But the good thing is when insulin is functioning normally, those locks are opening up and the glucose is able to move out of the bloodstream into the cells where it can be metabolized. What happens if you have insulin resistance? Well, first of all, there are not enough functional locks or insulin receptors. Now, it's true that the locks may be present, but they're not functioning. So I just drew a situation where there are much fewer locks. Now you eat your Entenmann's fat-free bakery product or your bagel for breakfast. It turns into glucose. It's absorbed as glucose. The pancreas senses that the blood sugar is rising. It secretes insulin. But look, there's only one lock that's available, that's functioning for that insulin to bind to. So you only got a little bit, one molecule of glucose to go into the cell. Now you have a situation where you have a bunch of insulin floating around the bloodstream and you still have a bunch of sugar. What do you think the pancreas is going to do? You've got sugar in your blood and that's not a good thing. So the pancreas is going to crank out some more insulin, and it's pretty good at that early on. And maybe a little bit more glucose will move into the cell. But this situation can go on and on for a period of time. And this situation that I'm showing you is what we consider prediabetes. People who are walking around with not diabetes, but they have slightly elevated glucose in their blood, and they usually have slightly elevated insulin too. So that was just the quick review to say that early on when we started this quest for low-fat diets to solve the problem of heart disease, we really were not aware that risk for heart disease was related to risk for diabetes, and now we know they are related. Yeah?
Can I just ask you a question?
Yes. The question was, why would the pancreas continue to secrete insulin? And it's because the glucose is remaining high. So as long as there's glucose in the blood, the pancreas feels it's its job to try to bring that glucose down. So it continues to secrete insulin. Yes. How does alcohol intake come into this picture? Alcohol preoccupies the liver. So there is a whole enzyme system called alcohol dehydrogenase that is in charge of detoxifying. Remember, alcohol is a toxin, and your liver is very busy metabolizing alcohol. It will not be properly metabolizing glucose. So if people have a pre-diabetic state, or certainly if they have diabetes, if they're consuming a lot of alcohol, you will see the blood sugar rise. Okay. Continuing on, couple more problems with low-fat diets. And this gets at your question from before in the front about calories. The problem with the fourth problem with low-fat diets is that in these early studies, we did not know as much about other dietary components. And we've found out since then that other dietary components matter. We have good data from the health professionals follow-up study, and this was part of or related to the Framingham study, if you're familiar with that. This was also a huge cohort, about 44,000 people aged 40 to 75 with no history of heart disease. And in this study, they were able to reproduce the same relationship I showed you before, that they were able to reproduce that correlation and say, yes, it's true. People who eat more saturated fat do indeed die more often from coronary heart disease. But when they were able to actually control for the amount of fiber that people were eating, that relationship went away. So what does that mean to you? Yes, people with high saturated fat diets suffered from more heart disease, but what do you think maybe their fiber intake looked like? It was low. So they were busy eating bacon and eggs and ice cream and cheese, and it turns out that that was not balanced with a good amount of fiber. So the high saturated fat diet eaters were also very low fiber eaters. The second thing that they found that was important in the study is that not all fat was bad. And in fact, linolenic acid, that's an omega-3 fatty acid that comes from walnuts and flax, it was actually protective against coronary heart disease. So these were two very important take-home messages from a much larger study to say, yes, it's true, saturated fat was related to heart disease, but people who eat a high saturated fat diet don't get enough fiber, and they're not getting enough of the good fats. And this slide shows that relationship. If you look at quintiles of saturated fat intake here on the x-axis, these are the people who ate the very least, lowest amount of saturated fat. Number five are the people who had a high saturated fat diet. And what you can see is that for all protective food groups, vegetables, whole grain cereals, fruits, alcohol, red wine, someone brought up before, and fish, as you consume more saturated fat, you tend to consume significantly less of all of the good stuff. So this was kind of a blow to these earlier studies because it really suggested that we ignored some very important protective components in the diet and that it was not all about how much fat you're eating. It was about good fat versus bad fat, and it was also about some of these other protective groups and protective foods. I think this is the final problem I wanted to point out, and it's really in the same vein. The final problem with low-fat diets is what we already alluded to with the margarine, and that is that trans fat, as it turns out, is worse than saturated fat. And these results come from a feeding study where they show the change in lipids when you replace carbohydrate with fat. And what you can see here in blue is the effect of saturated fat on the total cholesterol to HDL ratio. Now, let's just review quick. Remember our risk factors, the classical risk factors. Total cholesterol divided by HDL. HDL is the good stuff. So do you want your total cholesterol to HDL ratio, if you want to be healthy, do you want it to be high or low? You want it to be low, exactly, because you want this denominator as high as possible. You want it to be low. Well, the way to lower that ratio is to eat more polyunsaturated and monounsaturated. Remember, monounsaturated is coming mostly from olive oil. If this ratio is going up, which is a bad thing, one way to do it a little bit is with saturated fat, but the best way to make this ratio look bad is to eat trans fat, shown in green. LDL is raised more by trans fat, shown here in green, than it is by saturated fat. And HDL, the good cholesterol, is actually lowered by trans fat. So in all cases, all risk factors, trans fat is actually worse than saturated fat. And again, we did not know that when we told people to switch from butter to margarine. And I'll tell you, as a nutritionist, people are still mad at me about that. I think I was in grade school, but people say, when they find out I'm a nutritionist, they say, what is it with you people? Is it butter? Is it margarine? What's the deal? Because everybody thought they were really doing something good for their health when they switched to margarine. And it turns out they were consuming a lot of trans fat, and it was bad for their lipid profile. Yes?
Do you have any opinion about why the FDA
Why does the FDA still allow trans fat? Oh, that is that. It's a good question, and it's a whole talk on food politics. But I would say that the short answer is that it is so ubiquitous in our food system and the food industry that they're not able to totally wipe it out. I mean, they say in labeling that you can label something zero trans fat, and they've allowed the snack food companies to get away with this. But really, if a food contains less than 0.5 grams of trans fat per serving, they can say zero. And you can bet when you're eating snack foods, whether it's chips or cake mix, if it says zero, but the ingredient label says anything hydrogenated, partially hydrogenated, fully hydrogenated, you can bet that there's just less than 0.5 grams per serving. And if you look at like chips, like a bag of, let's say, Cheetos, a lot of kids, if you ride Muni around school time, every kid's got their bag of Cheetos. It's 3.5 servings in one of those bags. So if you've got almost 0.5 times 3.5, you have far and away exceeded the current recommendation, which actually is zero. Yeah?
I understand that recently found that there's two different kinds of LDL.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if we know enough about that that you could tell us something about it.
Yes. Yes. So the question is about different kinds of LDL, and this is another more recent discovery. We used to be very focused on total LDL, but what we find now is that there's a great deal of heterogeneity within this LDL family. So remember, this is a particle that's floating around your bloodstream carrying fat. But the particle comes in different sizes. And the two predominant sizes are a larger buoyant LDL, which is called pattern A, and then there's a smaller, more dense particle called pattern B LDL. And it turns out that this pattern B LDL is really the bad guy. It's the most atherogenic. It's the one that's most likely to infiltrate and contribute to plaque formation. So pattern B LDL is the bad guy. Now, it's not measured clinically, but experimentally, a lot of people are now measuring pattern B LDL. If you have, and this has been shown in men specifically, men with pattern B LDL, that's the small dense one, if they also have high triglycerides, low HDL, and insulin resistance, they have an 18-fold greater risk of a coronary heart disease event. So it's a big risk factor, and people are talking about that as atherogenic dyslipidemia. But this is not something you could go to your doctor and ask to measure. You'd have to be in a clinical trial or a feeding study. They're doing it experimentally. Okay, quick summary on what went wrong with fad diets. First of all, poor adherence. Remember the Women's Health Initiative. The women tried, and they stayed in that study for 8 years, but they never quite achieved a truly low fat, that 20% mark, and then they drifted up. The second one is misinterpretation. As a country, we thought we went on low-fat diets, but really we just started eating more calories, and most of those calories came from refined carbohydrates. The third problem is that we didn't know about metabolic syndrome. We did not fully understand the link between coronary heart disease and diabetes. The fourth problem is that we know now there are other dietary factors that are protective. So fruits and vegetables, for example, turn out to be protective for coronary heart disease. Fiber is protective. Good fats like linoleic acid are protective. And to you all, that seems obvious. But again, from a historical perspective, it's something we didn't know. And then finally, there are some real bad guys, and trans fat is the number one. So a lot of things went wrong with low-fat diets, a lot of things in terms of the science and metabolically, but I also think culturally people just got sick and tired of eating low-fat American cheese and, you know, snack wells and rice cakes. So it should be no surprise that the old Atkins diet made it back to the bestseller list. This was on the bestseller list starting in 1996 for 7 straight years, New York Times bestseller list. But actually, the Atkins diet has been around since 1860. It was first described by an undertaker named William Banting. And I feel like this is the big red flag, right? When an undertaker is telling us what to eat. That should just be, right? Everyone should take a moment and pause. But apparently, he wrote one of the first so-called diet bestseller books. It was called The Letter on Corpulence. He himself struggled with his weight. He discovered this low-carbohydrate diet, and he had some real success with it, and that was more than a century ago. A true low-carbohydrate diet is less than 20 grams per day. So just to put that into perspective, does anybody know what would be a food item that would have about 20 grams of carbohydrate?
A slice of bread.
A slice of bread. Fantastic. One slice of bread is right around 20 grams of carbohydrate. And this is 20 grams for the whole entire day. So one slice of bread and you're done for the day. So this is a diet that contains no bread, no rice, no pasta, no potatoes, no fruit, no juice, no dairy. Why is that? What's the sugar in dairy? Lactose, yeah. And that's interesting because it really, in the beginning, is a starvation diet in the sense that most people severely restrict their calories because they're left with what they feel is so little to eat. Yeah, actually, that does not turn out to happen. The question was, do you go into starvation mode? And I'll show you the results of some studies. One of our fears when people started going on these diets in the late 90s was that it was a disaster waiting to happen, right? Because it's a 64% fat diet. And remember, we were coming out of an era with the Keyes studies. We all thought fat was a big killer. We're all eating our Entenmann's fat-free bakery products, and suddenly people are eating bacon and eggs for breakfast, a steak and creamed spinach for lunch, and a double bacon cheeseburger for dinner. So people thought it's either a starvation diet or it's a heart attack waiting to happen. And I'll tell you, that's not actually how it turned out. So let me tell you first how Atkins works in theory. In theory, when you eat a very high-fat diet, remember the two situations we looked at, the isocaloric versus the Thanksgiving dinner. Fat is preferentially stored. But it turns out that if you eat a tremendous amount of fat, you can actually start to burn a little bit more fat. So that's one possible way that this works. You can increase your fat oxidation on an extremely high-fat diet. The second thing is ketosis. And this is kind of an alternate metabolic pathway that gets turned on when there's a lot of fat in the system. When fat burning, or what we call beta oxidation, gets maxed out, it turns on something called the Randall cycle, and fat is shunted in another metabolic direction, and it turns into ketones. So you can take fat and turn it into ketones, and in that way, you are breaking down fat even though you're on an extremely high-fat diet. Now, people who are on a truly low-carb diet will actually measure these ketones. I don't know if you've had friends or you've seen that. You can buy urine sticks and measure the ketones. They're excreted in your urine, a little bit in the stool, and they also are vaporized in the breath. So if someone is doing the Atkins diet right, you should be able to tell. This is how it works in theory, but how does it work in reality? And one of the people in the front here said it's a starvation diet. The truth is, if you look at the studies that have been done, it actually works primarily by calorie restriction. Okay. But in theory, you should be able to eat more calories on one of these low-carb diets and still lose weight. This is what an Atkins menu looks like. Remember I said, here's bacon and eggs for breakfast, bacon and cheeseburger for lunch, and then you have some sort of shrimp cocktail for dinner. And this, again, culturally was a big relief to people who had been eating plain dry toast, low-fat American cheese. They thought, oh, finally I get to have all the foods that I haven't had in 20 years. Remember, you can't have the bun with your burger. You can have a small salad because if you have too many fruits and vegetables, it's too much carbohydrate. Okay, so here are the big results that everybody was waiting for. This study came out in 2003. It was the first big clinical trial comparing a low-carbohydrate diet shown in orange to a conventional diet. So what do you think conventional diet means? Low fat, exactly, because we're coming out of this era of low fat. This was published, like I said, in New England Journal in 2003, and people were shocked to see that at 3 months and 6 months, the weight loss on the low-carb diet was significantly better than it was on the low-fat diet. Now, by 1 year, they had drifted back together, and this result was not significantly different. But what these results suggest is that the low-carb diet actually might be good for a kickstart. It might show some more rapid weight loss earlier on. I know it's hard to believe, but I'm going to try to convince you that in certain people, this might not be an unhealthy approach. So if you're not convinced by the end, we'll talk about it more. But I know, because this is what she is saying is, but it's not healthy. It's bacon and eggs 3 times a day and bacon cheeseburgers. But keep in mind, we're not putting you on the Atkins diet. We're talking about someone who is obese, who often has risk factors to begin with, and we'll talk about that more. So they may already have high triglycerides, low HDL, high LDL, and they are losing weight on this diet.
Yeah, if they're obese, fair enough, but I have loads of friends.
Yeah. Well, it hasn't been well studied in thin or, you know, kind of moderately overweight people. Yes.
What about the use of salt?
Salt?
Yeah.
Actually, there is not good evidence that salt alone contributes to obesity or that a low-salt diet will result in weight loss. So for people who are really trying to manage their weight, unless they have high blood pressure or hypertension and they are salt-sensitive, which, by the way, not a lot of people are salt-sensitive, meaning that most people, blood pressure is not severely affected by salt. But that's an aside. For people who are trying to manage their weight, I really de-emphasize salt. I know we have given the impression that it will have an effect, but salt should be secondary. Now, having said that, more than 75% of the salt that we eat in the United States, where do you think it comes from? And I'll tell you, it's not the salt shaker. It's processed food. So most of the salt we eat comes from processed food, packaged food, fast food. And those things we certainly know, especially fast food, there's good evidence, contributes to obesity. So it's all tied up together. I would focus on the fast food, but not necessarily the salt. Yeah.
There are some cultures.
That's right. That's right. There are some cultures, the point was made, that traditionally have very low carbohydrate, high fat diets, certain Eskimo cultures with whale blubber and so on. And actually, there have been studies done in those populations to see, and they do tend to have lower rates of coronary heart disease. So it's very interesting, and it might tie into this. Yes. It depends who you talk to. The question is, do dietitians recommend supplements? I'll tell you, this is one that goes back and forth. Traditionally, or I should say historically, every supplement trial that has ever come out has been a disappointment, meaning that the big clinical trials that have tried to supplement for example, beta carotene showed higher rates of cancer in the group that was supplemented. So the evidence to show that you can supplement with one nutrient here or one nutrient there really has not been successful. Some people, and sometimes I recommend a multivitamin to sort of with minerals to cover your bases, so to speak, but I never recommend a specific vitamin or not usually a specific mineral here and there. I recommend a multi if I feel that people have a poor diet and they need to kind of, like I said, cover their bases. Similarly, the fiber supplementation studies really have been a disappointment too. There is something in fruits and vegetables, and it's probably a lot of things, phytochemicals and other things, that cannot be captured yet in supplements. And so while study after study show that fruits and vegetables are protective, you cannot just give a fiber supplement and get that same effect. Yes.
Sodium.
Yes. This is such an interesting observation. They undertook a small clinical trial at their household over Easter. Mom was on the low-salt ham. No. And you really looked for the differences in sodium in the different hams, and what you found is that the unnitrated hams had a higher amount of salt. And what they're doing there is they're using a very old-fashioned technique that we've used for centuries to cure meat. They're adding more salt, and the salt is the curing agent. So it's a trade-off. We know that nitrates are related to cancer risk. So, you know, you're trading one for the other. The answer probably is to, you know, eat ham closer to around Easter and not, you know, not have it every day. By the way, I tasted that Trader Joe's ham. It was delicious because I remember they had a booth set up. And once you had a piece of that, you just had to buy the whole $30 ham, you know? Yeah. Well, these are all great questions, but I do want to just, and I think salt is a very interesting discussion with regard to hypertension, but for weight control, the salt alone really does not seem to make a difference. There certainly is something with very short-term water retention, if you eat, and you can feel this if you eat something extremely salty, but in terms of real weight control, salt alone is not going to do the trick. So the take-home message from this first big clinical trial was that the weight loss on the low-carb diet was better than the low-fat diet short-term. And guess what? There were some real benefits to lipid profile. In fact, the low-carb diet raised or maintained HDL. Remember, that's the healthy cholesterol. And it tended to lower triglycerides. People were shocked that this was true, and it was not true for the low-fat diet. So there were some real benefits in terms of lipid profile to losing weight on the low-carb diet. Blood pressure and insulin resistance improved on both diets. And finally, the compliance was better on the low-carb diet. So people tended to stick to the low-carb diet longer. Remember, we talked about some of the problems with the low-fat diet over 8 years, how people tended to trail off. So like I said, this was published in 2003, and it was a real shocker because people were ready to say, I cannot believe low-carb diets could have any benefits. And sure enough, they seemed to. Moving on to the next category of diets called the low glycemic index diets. This group includes the South Beach diet, which hit the New York Times bestseller list. No coincidence, right after the Atkins diet was dwindling, people were getting sick of bacon and eggs, the South Beach diet made its debut. Low glycemic index diets very generally are lower sugar, lower starch diets, but they're not low carbohydrate diets. And I show some here. South Beach is the best known. The Zone is a slightly lower glycemic index diet also. But what I want to show you here is how a lower glycemic index diet may actually produce weight loss. First of all, what is glycemic index? It's a system of classifying foods by the amount of sugar or available carbohydrate that they contain. It's been long used by people who have diabetes, but it was only very recently recognized by the American Diabetes Association. Very generally, high glycemic index foods are high in sugar and starch, and some fruits, like my favorite watermelon and pineapple, is high sugar also. Low glycemic index foods are legumes, grains, vegetables, and some fruits, like berries, tend to be low glycemic index. What lowers glycemic index? Two things. Number one, fiber lowers the glycemic load. And the reason is shown here. This is supposed to show a kernel of wheat. And what you can see here, if you look at a blown up picture of the kernel, is that it's protected by a very nice shell called the bran. Now here they sliced it open for this picture. And what you have inside of this kernel is the nice fluffy endosperm of that cell. That is the starch. And here you have the wheat germ, and this contains some really nice things like vitamin E, for example. Well, what do we do in the United States when we refine flour? We crack this open, grind it down as much as possible. We get rid of the bran. We get rid of the germ because the germ can oxidize and tends to spoil the flour faster. And we leave ourselves with this really nice, white, fluffy flour. It's just the starch. Now, if you ate whole grains, and I mean truly whole grains, where you can see the bran in there and the kernel is cracked, but you can still see it, this bran serves to protect the fluffy white endosperm from the digestive enzymes. So if you eat a truly whole grain piece of bread, and I mean that old-fashioned European bread, you know, where it's really dense, it's not fluffy. If you drop the loaf on your toe, you could break your toe. It's the whole loaf is this big. The slices are really thin. They bend and they break. They're not soft and fluffy. That's a truly whole grain bread where the kernels are just smashed and they're almost intact. the digestive enzymes have trouble getting into that starch. And as a result, the blood sugar rise from one of those pieces of bread is very, very slow. The other thing that brings down the glycemic load, or the amount of sugar that goes into the blood, is fat. If you add fat to a meal, it delays gastric emptying. That means it makes the food sit in your stomach longer, and as a result, the sugar takes much more time to go out into the bloodstream. Now, this can be used in a very smart way. For example, if you're going to have a bagel for breakfast, it would be much smarter for your blood sugar control to have half of a bagel with some peanut butter or some hummus on it, because the fat in the peanut butter or the fat in the hummus will slow the absorption of that carbohydrate. And you might have noticed, if you've ever done that, that you're fuller longer. Whereas if you just eat the whole plain bagel, the carbohydrate is very rapidly absorbed and you're hungry quickly. So these slow the digestion. The bad thing about the fat is that it works the other way too. You can take a donut and deep fry it, and it will, in theory, decrease the glycemic load. So it's not necessarily always a healthy strategy, but the medical students are always relieved to hear that, you know, like, phew, we're good with the donut. It's lower glycemic load. You really have to read the label to find a good whole grain bread, and here are two tricks. Number one, start with the ingredient list. The first ingredient should say whole grain or whole wheat or whole rye or whole barley, whatever you like, but it should say the word whole first. If it says wheat flour, that means white flour. The second trick is try to find a bread, look on the nutrition facts, and look at dietary fiber, and you should try to find one that has 3 grams of fiber or more. Okay. So I want to show you one of the seminal studies that was done on glycemic index to really suggest why eating a plain bagel or eating those Fruit Loops for breakfast leaves you hungrier and may contribute to weight gain. And this was done by Ludwig and colleagues at Harvard back in 1999. And what they did is a feeding study where they compared a low glycemic index breakfast to a high glycemic index breakfast. The low is shown in green, and you can see these meals are very, very different. The green meal was basically an egg and cheese omelet, a veggie omelet. The high glycemic was basically sugared cereal. It was instant oatmeal with added sugar. And these graphs that I want to take you through now show the biochemical effect of eating a low versus a high glycemic meal. Again, in the green is shown the result of the blood glucose curve as a result of the omelet. You can see the blood glucose after eating the omelet increases slightly, and it comes down slowly by about 2 or 3 hours. It levels off back to baseline. That's the glucose response in the bloodstream from eating an omelet. Look at this huge rise from the sugared cereal. It's a tremendous spike. It comes down much more rapidly. The slope is much more sharp. And what do you notice here? At about 4 hours, the blood sugar, as a response to that sugared cereal, drops below baseline. And it's just slightly below baseline. This person, you would probably not even pick up in a clinical setting, but in an experimental setting, you can show that the people who ate the sugared cereal became slightly subclinically hypoglycemic at about 4 or 5 hours. And we're going to talk about the possible, what that can result in. The insulin looks almost just the same. And remember, that's insulin's job. When it sees glucose in the system, it is secreted by the pancreas, and the curves are mirrored. So when you eat sugared cereal, you have a much bigger insulin spike. Okay, remember this. Let's look at what happened during fasting. Again, the omelet kids had a very nice rise after they ate the omelet, and of glucagon. Glucagon is a key fasting hormone. It's a good hormone that is secreted between meals, and its job is to send out fuel. So it breaks down stores, it breaks down fat, it breaks down sugar, it gets it out into the system to fuel your body in between meals. This is a normal fasting response. What do you see here in the sugared cereal group? Their glucagon is suppressed. So this is not a normal fasting response. And in fact, because of this response, the body is not being properly fueled in between meals. And you can see that here. Fat is a very important source of fuel between meals when you're fasting. And in the group that had sugared cereal, where this arrow shows, you can see the fatty acids are suppressed right around 3 or 4 hours. So when you look at this picture, how do you think the sugared cereal group felt? They have suppressed glucagon and they're not getting enough fuel. How do you think they felt?
Tired
and hungry. Exactly. And in fact, as a response to that, the sugared cereal group has a huge spike in counter-regulatory hormones. This is plasma epinephrine, which we also call adrenaline. It spikes at about 4 hours after the breakfast. Growth hormone is another counter-regulatory hormone. You can see a big spike here in the sugared cereal group. This is an attempt by the body to say, hey, we're not properly fueled. We need to break down some stores and get some fuel into the system. So you have a huge surge. Imagine this is 4 hours after breakfast, so it's right around noon. And then the researchers very cleverly gave the kids, these were adolescents, access to lunch. The kids did not know the lunch was weighed out and measured, but we always do that in the laboratory. And sure enough, the ones who had the sugared cereal, when they had free access to lunch, they ate 81% more calories than those who had the omelet. So this was some very, very good evidence back in 1999 that high sugar, high glycemic load foods leave you hungrier and actually make you want to eat more in between meals. And I like to show this study because it's so it illustrates the concept so well. But you should know that this has now been repeated in a school setting. It's been repeated in a 1-year clinical trial, and it's been repeated in a 2-year clinical trial, which I'll show you in a little while. But the bottom line is there really is something to this. If you can lower the glycemic load, you will probably feel less hungry, and hopefully you'll snack less, and that will help for weight control. Yes? So this is a very interesting. The question is, do children, if you give them free access to food, will they pick what is good for them? It's a tricky one because Leanne Birch is another scientist who have really studied this extensively. She actually has a feeding laboratory where she has a bunch of 5-year-olds come in. And it seems to depend on the social cues that are present. So, for example, if you put a big plate of cookies with a sign, this is 5 years old, that says, do not eat, they eat more cookies. And if kids are overweight, which we assume maybe they've been exposed to messages maybe at home or at school, oh, you shouldn't have that, watching your weight, shouldn't have that, those kids tend to overeat also. So it's a tricky business. It's hard to say. We know that infants are very, very good at regulating their food intake. So, you know, infants are not walking around asking, does my butt look big in these diapers, you know? They are totally unconcerned with social cues, and they are truly eating for hunger and satiety, and they're excellent at controlling their food intake. But I tell you, it's a sad story. We very quickly can override those instincts as well. Bottle feeding might be one way that we overfeed even infants because we're not allowing them to use their own cues. So it's tricky business, and I'll tell you, we tend to overfeed ourselves, especially in the United States, and it starts very, very early on. Yeah. The comment was about eating in eating style in Europe, and we talked a little bit about different foods and so on, but in terms of the American diet, portion size is very, very important. And it comes back to the point that was made earlier about calories. Even if you really are trying to eat well, low glycemic load, some of these concepts, if you are eating too many calories, we saw that, right, in the feeding study, you will gain weight. So it's not just the type of food. Portion size is very important. Okay. So I hope I've convinced you here that there is something to this idea of starch and sugar, and it tends to increase hunger, and people, it may contribute to overeating and weight gain. So the last group of diets that I want to review is the Mediterranean diet. And one example of the Mediterranean diet comes from Harvard. So Walter Willett, his food guide pyramid is really based on the concepts of the Mediterranean diet. But the Mediterranean diet is hard to describe because it really involves a group of many, many diets. Here are the common features, though. Among 16 Mediterranean diets, they tend to include fruits and vegetables, breads and other cereals. They do include potatoes, beans, nuts, and seeds. They tend to be higher in fat than what the American Heart Association recommends, but the fat comes from monounsaturated fat, such as olive oil, and it emphasizes these omega-3 fats from walnuts, fish, and flaxseed. It does include dairy, fish and poultry, but there's less red meat than what we traditionally eat here in the U.S. Eggs are allowed up to 4 per week, and red wine is included. So that's the more good news for the Mediterranean diet. One of the first studies on the Mediterranean diet was called the Lion Diet Heart Study. And this was a large study in 605 subjects who had a known history of heart disease. So these were people who had already had a heart attack, and then they were enrolled in the study. They were randomized to either the Mediterranean diet that's shown in green or no dietary intervention at all. And what they found is that people on the Mediterranean diet had much lower rates of death from all causes, from cardiovascular disease and from cancer and all causes. And in fact, those results were so astounding that they had to stop the study at 1 year for ethical reasons, because they felt that it wasn't fair to those, it was not ethical to those who were not on the Mediterranean diet. So they stopped the study at 1 year, they put everyone on the Mediterranean diet and continued from there. But like I said, these results were truly astounding because they showed, they suggested that there's something really to the Mediterranean diet in terms of cardiovascular risk and other health complications. Now, one problem is that we don't know what the other group was eating, and that's a problem with the study when you don't have two groups to directly compare. Nevertheless, it was some interesting evidence in the 1990s that the Mediterranean diet really could do something good. So I want to just recap, before we move on to this final section, what I've shown you so far, I hope, is that the low-fat diets can have cardiovascular benefit if they're done correctly. Remember the Ornish studies. The low-carb diets can show some really nice short-term weight loss, and they actually can be good for lipid profiles in people who have high triglycerides and low HDL. Finally, these low glycemic index diets may help control overeating. But the question is, how do they compare? And this was the big question that everyone was waiting for, right? We kind of marched through the 1990s, and I showed you one study in 2003, but a lot of health professionals were saying, well, I won't believe it until I see them all compared. So here's the number one big-time clinical trial comparing the major diets. This was published in JAMA in 2005, and this was among 160 adults aged 22 to 74 who were obese, so the BMI of 35. And what you can see here is a really disappointing slide. What it basically shows is that if you compare the Atkins to the Zone, remember Zone was low glycemic index, to Weight Watchers, which tends to be lower in fat with social support, to the Ornish diet, which is a truly low fat, the vegan diet, there was no difference after 1 year in the weight loss among the groups. Big bummer, because everyone was rooting for their own diet. So this was some very early evidence, in the section we're talking about now. This was one of the first studies to compare and show nothing. But before you become disheartened, here's the second big comparison diet. This was done by Christopher Gardner and colleagues at Stanford, and it was published also in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2007. This study now had a much more restricted group of individuals that enrolled. It was all women. It was a much bigger group, almost double. It was over 300 women. They were postmenopausal, so it was a much tighter age group, and they were non-diabetic. Oh, sorry, premenopausal. But still, thank you. But the point being, instead of 22 to 74 years old, you had a tighter age group of women, but thank you. They were also obese. And what you can see if you compare the Zone to the Learn diet, which is another low fat, to the Ornish, to the Atkins, it was the Atkins diet shown in the triangles that beat out all of the other diets in terms of weight loss. And this was weight loss at 6 months and at 12 months. The last study comparison in terms of weight that I wanted to show today, the most recent one in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2008, compared a low-fat diet shown in red to a Mediterranean diet shown in yellow to a low-carbohydrate diet shown in blue. And this was a nice study design. It actually went out for 2 years. And what you can see is that both the Mediterranean and the low-carb diet beat out the low-fat diet. So both of these showed better weight loss than low-fat. So hopefully you're asking, what the heck is going on? What could explain such different results? These were all huge, multi-million dollar clinical trials, and they show some really different results. On the one hand, we have no effect. On the other hand, we have Atkins seems to win out. And then to add to that, Atkins and the Mediterranean looked really good in that last study. So the question for me, and what I've been very interested in, is why might certain individuals respond differently to different diets? And I emailed this question to Christopher Gardner at Stanford, and he was nice enough to send me this slide. Remember, he was the one who did the study, the second one I showed you, where the Atkins beat out the other diets. And what he did is he asked this question. He asked, what's the difference between the low-fat diet, the Ornish, and the low-carbohydrate diet if you look at individual women who are insulin-sensitive, which means, remember the locks and keys, insulin-sensitive means these women are healthy, locks and keys are working, versus the insulin-resistant women. Those are the women who had prediabetes. And what he showed is that for women who are insulin sensitive, they tend to have success on either diet. It didn't seem to matter whether they were on low carb or low fat. But if you look at women who are insulin resistant, they had much better weight loss on the low carbohydrate diet. So this is a first suggestion, and again, this was just our personal communication. It was a small group. You can see there's only 20 in each group, but it's the beginning of a suggestion that perhaps for people who have this metabolic syndrome-looking picture or this pre-diabetes-looking picture, those individuals might benefit from a lower carbohydrate diet. And there's more evidence to suggest that. This is a large study that came from the Ludwig group at Harvard. It was an 18-month study. And as you can see, again, when they took young adults aged 18 to 35, they split them out to just show the ones who had insulin resistance. So these are just people who had the prediabetes-looking picture. The ones who have prediabetes lose much more weight on a low glycemic load diet as compared to a low-fat diet. So the question is, why would this be? Why would this be? And I'll tell you, it's not answered. But here's one theory that has not been sufficiently tested. Why would people with prediabetes fare better on a carbohydrate-restricted diet? Remember the prediabetes picture. That was the one where the locks were not opening. There was a lot of glucose floating around, and there was a lot of insulin floating around. Well, insulin is, even if it's not working correctly, insulin is the primary storage hormone in the body. And the idea is that if you are insulin resistant, perhaps you are in perpetual storage mode. And if you are feeding that insulin a lot of glucose, even though it's not doing a great job, it is doing its best to put that glucose into storage. If you can reduce the amount of glucose that's available to that hormone, it may help you lose weight. That's the theory. And again, it's a very difficult to test because you'd have to really start with people who don't have insulin resistance, watch the progression of it, see if they gain weight. But at least that's the theory. Yes? That's right. That's right. So the question was, doesn't carbohydrate turn to sugar? Yes, it does. In fact, a piece of bread, white bread, turns into glucose just like that. And if you eat less carbohydrate, you are putting less sugar into your bloodstream. That's right. People who have insulin resistance tend to have more visceral fat, so that's the central adiposity, and that is actually an independent risk factor for coronary heart disease. So at 6 months, both groups stabilized from 6 to 18 months, but the overall weight loss in this lower glycemic load is much better overall. But it's true, it would be much more impressive, for instance, if you saw this group kept decreasing. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. This is, again, a whole talk for another day on leptin. Maybe next year we can do. But this is a phenomenon on all diets, all weight loss drugs. There is a plateau, and it is partly due to hormonal reasons. Yes. You can be insulin resistant as a thin person, absolutely, but it is much, much more common in people who are overweight. And weight gain does seem to exacerbate insulin resistance. But again, that's a tricky egg and chicken question that has not fully been answered experimentally. The reigning theory is that people become insulin resistant because they are becoming overweight. Yes?
Yeah, The Ornish, the whole Ornish program, it's not a lose weight program. Mm-hmm. It's a deal with heart disease program. Mm-hmm. And he does these studies that, look into the vein arteries, mm-hmm. and see how much blockage there is. And has that been done with other diets?
Not to my knowledge. So this idea where you really can show a cross section of an artery and image it and show that there is a regression in plaque formation, I've not seen that in any other study. Most studies are very focused on dyslipidemia. And I'll just quickly, to wrap up, I'll show you, because I have to convince this woman here that the lipid profiles actually really improve on the Atkins diet. So that's what I'll just finish with. The question is, yes, on these comparison studies, this is again the Gardner study, remember from Stanford, yes, the Atkins people lost more weight, but they were eating bacon, eggs, and double bacon cheeseburgers for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. What happened to their lipids? Well, remember the five big ones, the risk factors for metabolic syndrome. Here they are: triglycerides, HDL, blood pressure, this is systolic and diastolic, and then glucose. And if you look at those five risk factors, which are part of the constellation of metabolic syndrome, four out of those five were most significantly improved on the Atkins diet. Triglycerides were lowered, HDL increased, and blood pressure was lowered. So again, the Atkins diet came out looking good. Now remember, these people lost the most weight, and these improvements are inextricably linked to weight loss. Weight loss is a great way to improve your lipids, but it also shows that when you're losing weight, if you are obese and you have some risk factors, that they are going to improve with weight loss on an Atkins diet. They did improve on these other diets, but not as significantly. Even the Ornish diet, the triglycerides, were only half as improved as they were on the Atkins. I wanted to just show you quickly this is the same graphical setup looking at the five risk factors, but now we're looking at the study that compared the low carb, the Mediterranean, and the low fat. Remember the red, the yellow, and the blue. And again, the low carb diet in terms of these two risk factors came out looking good. It really improved triglycerides and HDL, but you have to give the Mediterranean diet some credit. On these other risk factors, it really seemed to improve. So this is a suggestion, and this is one of the first big ones that included Mediterranean diet, that when it comes to some of these risk factors, the Mediterranean diet can do a good job too. And I wanted to just, I think these are the last data slide I'd like to show. The Mediterranean diet study did one interesting comparison that I wanted to point out, because remember, my point to you today is that one size does not fit all, and that individuals seem to respond differently to different diets. And what they did with the Mediterranean diet study is they split out people who had diabetes. And what they showed here is that among people who don't have diabetes, in terms of their glucose control, their glycemic control, there really didn't seem to be any difference. patients and people who don't have diabetes. But if you pull out just the subject who have diabetes and you look at the change in their blood glucose over 6 months, 12 months, and 24 months, the orange line shows that on the Mediterranean diet, the glucose decreased significantly in people who have diabetes. So here's a suggestion now that for people who have diabetes and are trying to control their blood sugar, the Mediterranean diet might have some real benefits. So to sum all of this up, the low-fat diet, such as the Ornish and the Learn, can have cardiovascular benefit if they are done correctly, and they can actually show some weight loss. But on a population level, I hope I convinced you, it's very difficult to sustain a low-fat diet. It has been misinterpreted by the public, and it ignores the type of fat. So this idea where you can just put everyone on a low-fat diet really ignored some good things, especially this idea of the monounsaturated and the omega-3s. Low-carbohydrate diets, like the Atkins, showed better weight loss. They showed improved risk factors for people with metabolic syndrome. But the problem with the Atkins diet, and this I will give you, it is really low in many nutrients. It is almost devoid of, you know, vitamin C and some other very important ones, and it's extremely low in fiber and calcium. So there's some real problems in thinking about Atkins, especially in children, where we know they have much higher needs for growth. So this is something that we don't use in our childhood obesity clinic. But I will tell you, here at UCSF, they do use this in the adult weight management program, especially if people need to lose weight rapidly for a surgery, for example. In terms of a final summary, the lower glycemic load diets showed better weight loss than low fat for people who have insulin resistance. And the Mediterranean diet showed better weight loss than low fat and maybe specific benefits for people who have diabetes. The good news, as opposed to the previous slide, is that both of these diets can meet the current dietary guidelines. So if people really want to manage their weight, this might be the way to go. Reduce the glycemic load and try the Mediterranean diet, which in many ways has the same effect. And they can do so while still getting enough vegetables, still getting sufficient amount of fiber and calcium. So I just wanted to end with some very key messages. Number one, one diet does not fit all. Number two, stick with it. So adherence really does matter. And when they look in these studies, people who stick to the diets longer do the best. So some people love the Atkins diet, and that might be one reason why they do so well, because they really enjoy it. And then finally, calories count. I have to end on this message because in practice, especially, for example, where I'm working with teenagers, we cannot ignore this concept that calories do count. And in fact, when I work with teenagers, we start by targeting behaviors. I never get to the part with teenagers where I talk about glycemic load or insulin resistance, you know, eyes are glazing over. But what we do talk about is soda. We talk about junk food and fast food. In adults, alcohol is a big contributor of calories. And then some other big behaviors, increasing vegetables and whole grains, reducing portions, as mentioned, eating out less. Simply eating at home more often will reduce calories, since we tend to eat such big portions when we go out. And packing lunch is an important one for all of us, but especially for adolescents. And I'll just leave on this last slide to show a model that we created for our clinic. This we use primarily with kids, but instead of a pyramid or something that doesn't translate into every day, we actually created a plate because kids can relate to this. You think about, what does your plate look like at breakfast, lunch, and dinner? It should have whole grains instead of refined carbohydrate, and the portion should be small. These are for kids who are obese who are coming to us for weight management. So it's one slice of whole grain bread instead of two. Protein at every meal, now you know why, right? If you don't have protein at breakfast, what happens? Get hungry sooner, great. And then fruits and vegetables should make up the major part of the plate. Incidentally, this should be really mostly vegetables, because fruit is contributing a lot of sugar. And then we're trying to make fats the essential fats to make them sound fancier, more appealing, but this means the mono and polyunsaturated. And then because kids do have a higher calcium requirement, we do include a low-fat dairy or soy milk with meals. So with that, I will just end. I want to thank everybody, but of course I'm here for questions. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.